session number 16808, rule 16.
Rosebittle's rule 16.
Yes, so we were intending to support one of the battalions of the infantry brigade, and I couldn't tell you offhand which one it was now, but our squadron was to do that. Well, there were two large villages that were involved, Couverville and Demerville. Well, I think Couverville was the first one, not quite sure. Anyway, it was one of those two villages that we had to deal with, which would eliminate any danger from the flanks, the right flank of the brigade, who were going to go straight down the valley and attacked Bourjolbus Ridge and the villages in the valley. Anyway, that was going to be the job of the three tank regiments of the brigade, but our particular job was to eliminate these two villages. So we get to go, and we start off through this gap, and almost immediately Mr. Dolby, who was our new troop leader, hits a mine and blows a track. Well, the normal procedure is then that the troop leader uses one of the other tanks and takes it over and carries on with the action. And so with that in mind, Jack Mann, the sergeant, was closer to him than I was, so he pulled across to swap over tanks. And as he gets to him, he hits a mine and blows a track. So that virtually put our troop out of action. So I just drove through the gap and pulled over to one side out of everybody's way. And when the rush had gone, we towed the two tanks out into the field, or into, away from the gap, and towed the tracks out. And between us, that's like 15 of us, between us, after several hours hard work, we got the two tracks repaired and put back on the tanks, enabling us to rejoin the squadron while the fighting was going on. And we was like reserve troop then. And anyway, they'd had a big air raid previous to this, leading on to it. And when you read the newspaper reports, they said about the Germans being so traumatised that they were just walking out and giving themselves up. Well, although we were late getting there, the fighting that was going on, it didn't seem to me they were very traumatised. And but the situation was dealt with. The infantry took the village, and that was that. Well, then, to take the next village, which was about a mile and a half further on, obviously they were alerted to what was happening, and it needed C squadron and A squadron to support the 2nd battalion to take the 2nd village, which we did. B squadron in the meantime were protecting the right flank and the rear of our two squadrons that were involved in the villages, because there was still enemy in the Columbell's factory area that hadn't shifted out. Anyway, we takes these villages, these two, liquidates those, and it was, by now it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we thought, well, that's it, our job's done. Yes, so about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you see, and we dealt with the villages, so our job was done, and we thought, well, we'll be at the old brew on now, and might even get something to eat, you know. But no, what happened was that the armoured brigade, they'd carried on down the valley, and there's several railway lines run across the valley, and they crossed those, and the situation, as I recall, the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment had been given the job of taking the ridge, and they had expected to take it that day. And so Braz and Hubert Foley were their objectives. Now, across the valley, at about 3,000 or 4,000 yards before you get to the villages, was a railway line on a high embankment, about 30 feet, 40 feet high, with the usual farmers' bridges, tunnels through, you see, for the track, horse and carts and things like that. And all appeared to be going well up until they got to this high embankment. Now, the 5th and 4th of Yeomanry and the 23rd Hussars, they were down in the valley working their way across. And I don't want to talk about them because I was never involved with them, so I only know what's in the books. But we were actively involved with the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment. Now, what had happened, we were resting. 3rd Royal Tank Regiment were now down in the valley, and they crossed, gone through the arches, so they were now committed, basically, to the last 3,000 or 4,000 yards up to the ridge for Braz and Hubert Folly. And unfortunately, the distance from Carn to Borduas Ridge and the fact of the congestion of everything involved, they had not been able to get the mobile 25s forward to be able to fire on the ridge. And there'd been no bombardment on the ridge. They had a heavy bombardment south of Carn, which you read about, and they say it gave them a good start. It did nothing of the sort. What it actually did, they bombed the Canadians, and they bombed a part of one of our regiments. That was before the action started. The Canadians were put back an hour and a half. But the bombing raid itself, as compared to the books, it did, in practical terms, nothing at all. The ridge, Borduas Ridge, was not touched. Why they never brought telephones in or not, I do not know. But the artillery couldn't get forward soon enough on the first day to be able to support. And it was obviously hoped that the 3rd Tank Regiment, with these 17-pounder Shermans mingled in with the 75s, would be able to cope with anything on the ridge. Well, when they told us to get on the move, to go down and support the 3rd Royal Tanks, I could never in any way imagine what had happened. They'd gone through these arches, and there'd been some firing at the ridge, some firing back from the ridge, not of any great account from all accounts, until they got through into the valley. They were the wrong side of this high embankment, and they'd become committed, the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, and they were being slaughtered. They thought they were going to drive up on the ridge, and the Tigers and anti-tank guns and everything up. Now, a Tiger tank with an 88 could knock any tank out at a mile. The 3rd tanks had got 3,000 or 4,000 yards to go, and their guns didn't even reach. The only ones that reached were the 17-pounders. And when you look at a Sherman tank and you see the short 75s and the massive, great, long 17-pounders, it's obvious which ones the Germans are going to fire at first, and which they did. And the outcome of it was that the 3rd Tank Regiment finished up with 14 tanks left out of the regiment by the time it got dark and they were able to withdraw. We were told to go down and support them. Well, we got about 5 miles to go. We got railways to cross. There was the shambles of the fighting that was left behind to get through. So it was 7 o'clock at least, at the earliest, 7 o'clock before we got down there. And I'd never seen anything like it. The valley was full of black smoke. There were Shermans burning, blowing up. There was blokes walking about all over the place. Some individually, aimlessly walking about, bomb happy as anything. They had got a clue where they were, totally disoriented. There was blokes helping wounded blokes, and it was a total shambles. And when we got down there, we're the right side of the ridge to start with, and when we're looking across, at this time the Germans hadn't basically fired at us, because they obviously wait for us to go through the wrong side of the ridge, and this embankment. And we're sitting there reserving initially until somebody makes the mind up what to do. So then they says, right, two squadrons will proceed through the arches in direct support and fire at the ridge. And if I remember right, my squadron went through, and I believe the other one was B squadron. And we went through these arches, and immediately we become under fire because we couldn't escape. It was like a rat trap. You know, you can only get one tank through at a time. These bridges have been built for horse and carts. And so we get through, and we spreads out, and they said, select your own targets. We couldn't see any targets. And it wasn't until we eventually got on the ridge the next day that you could see what the Germans had done, although you guess what they'd done. And they'd had the bulldozers up, and they'd dug out these pits. So the Tigers, or whatever, could drive in, and only the gun was level with the ground. And what bit of turret there was above it could be seen. And they'd fire from one position, and as soon as you got a flash to fire at, by the time you got your gun laid on it, it wasn't there. It moved into the next one, and they got them along the... And they was operating from one to another of these dugouts, these Tiger tanks and such, plus the anti-tank guns dug in on the forward slopes. And you just had nothing to fire at. So I don't know what anyone else did. But as an individual tank commander, I said to Bill Barnett, my co-driver, who has a Beza machine gun down in the front, I said, Bill, I said, you can do as you like with your pea shooter. I said, if you think you can see anything, have a shoot at it. I said, and we'll do what we can from the turret. I said, well, all we'll do, I said, when we say a flash to Denny Wells, my gunner, I said, keep your eye on. I said, when you say a flash, I said, I'll tell you about how far I think it is. I said, and then we'll have a couple of smoke shells and an HE shell. No good for an AP, because if you miss it with an inch, it's done no damage. But if you put smoke down, with the smoke that was already there from the burning tanks, and the fact that by now you're getting on to 8 o'clock towards 9 o'clock, summertime, evening mist is coming up in the valley, and gradually the valley's filling up with smoke and mist, you see. And all you can see is these flashes. So I said, well, the best thing, couple of smoke shells and an HE, and B's the just machine gun, well, nothing really, just machine gun in the area, and make it unpleasant. I couldn't see any other thing that you could do, you know. So that's what we did, yeah, as an individual tank. What anyone else did, I don't know. I mean, when you read books, there's people say they knocked out so many tanks, they saw this and they saw that. Well, for myself, in all honesty, I saw nothing except flashes. And that was what I did to, ease the situation. And as it got dark, of course, you couldn't see anyway. And they then decided that our two squadrons should back up to the embankment with their tail end on the bank, up again the bank, switch your engines off and sit there in the dark, you see. And the Germans, having nothing obvious to fire at, they sort of stopped firing, except that occasionally, obviously, if one of them thought he could see something or heard something, they'd fire a shell and it would go into the bank, and then you big clods of earth would come up and shower down on you, like, you know. But anyway, then as time wore on, it got to sort of midnight. And you couldn't just sit there all night, because if you left it till daylight, they're just going to pop you off again and nothing will be achieved. So they infiltrated us back through the arches, one at a time. And rather than no good starting the whole lot up, you see, just one tank start up and dash around, you see, because, I mean, in a cruise, I mean, you can do 45 mile an hour. So if you're choosing your own speed, you can go fast, whereas if you've got several tanks milling about, you can't, you see. So they chose to have one tank at a time and slip through the arches, like, you know. That way we got back the two squadrons the other side of the railway, you see. And they had to sort out what was what, who was where and all that. And it appears we lost 16 tanks that day. We lost four up at the villages and another 12 down at the ridge, you say, in the railway bank. Anyway, that was put right through the night, and we just had time to get a brew on, and that was about all, no time for food. And by about 5 o'clock, we're ready to move back in again, you see. Again, I speak for my own squadron and my own troop, but we were the first troop through of my squadron through one of these arches. And Jackman said he'd take the lead, so he went through first. I followed him, Mr. Dolby followed me. Well, when we got the other side, we drove a few hundred yards, and it was all sort of rough country, as though an area where you sometimes find farmers have an area in an area where they dump rubbish, and it becomes all hills and hollers, and weeds and scrub grows on it, like, you know. And it was a similar area to that. And we drove through, and this sort of a track went through it. And we drove into this area of humpty bumps and bumps. And Jack stopped, so naturally I stopped. I was about 50 yards behind him, and Mr. Dolby about 100 yards behind me. And it's about half past 5 in the morning, you see. The old mist is there and all that. But we're this side of the slope, so we're beginning to look across the mist to the valley, to the ridge. And we've got our binoculars out. We're sort of looking for signs of life and everything. And suddenly, behind Jackman's tank, these shells came in. And big clods of earth were going up in the air. And it was obviously AP shells, you see, for an 88 or something. Obviously, they would be 88, usually are. So I said on the B set, I said, hello, Abel, you're being fired at. I should move your tank. Well, Jack, he didn't move immediately. He did what I suppose what I would have done, perhaps done myself, because I said he'd been fired at from behind, you see. So he eases himself up to look over the back, because I think I may have told you, but we soon learned that snipers, as they called them, were killing tank commanders. And in a tank commander, if he'd only got his head above the turret, the flaps of a turret, you got in half, so you got a flap each side, and your head is in more or less like a rifle sighting. So we put some sacks of soil, like sandbags type of thing, on the roof of the turret behind the commander's head. So his head was virtually in three sides of a box, you see, and he just looked forward. Unless he turns his cupola independently, you see. But normally, travelling forward, your head's in three sides of a box. It does mean, of course, you've got to push yourself higher up at the turret to look over the back, which Jack does. He pushes himself up and looks over the back. And simultaneously as he's doing this, it seemed to me about five shells went straight into it, the back end, like the engine and that. And immediately it started to burn. But with Cromwells, they don't blow up like Shermans. You have time to get out, normally, and you even have time to get back in and help someone who can't get out, usually. But you can't do this in a Sherman. As soon as they get it, they burn and they blow. And normally. Anyway, Jack bails out, you say. He all jumps out and starts running back towards the arch. But Jack, having jumped out, the back of his tank was one mass of flame. It was all low flames, as though you'd poured paraffin over it and put a match to it. About 18 inches high, these flames. All even. It was an amazing sight, really. And he's leaning into the tank turret head first, and I could see that obviously something was wrong. So I pulled forward on his right hand side, so if they fired, they got to hit him again before they could hit me, you see. Excuse me. So anyway, I gets out over onto Jack's tank, and it was Billy McCall, his gunner, and he'd had a shell, took a piece of his thigh away, so he was a bit incapacitated. But between us, we get him out, and we get him on the back of my tank, and Jack's on the back with him, like, and then we drives forward, makes a big wide sweep round. Of course, as soon as this happened, Mr. Dolby does the obvious, he starts reversing back to the arch, you see. And we does a big wide sweep round, and he's gone through, and we come through the arch, and almost immediately the MO's there with his half track, and Billy Paul's taken away, Billy McCall is taken away, and that's it, you see. Well, the action carried on from there, And it just shows you they bring these tanks up quick, because by 12 o'clock, Jack Mann had got a new gunner and the rest of his crew, and he got a tank news back and joined the troop again by 12 o'clock. And, let's see if I didn't drop in here. By 12 o'clock, Jack Mann is back and rejoined the troop with another tank. And we carried on. Well, then it appears the 3rd Tank Regiment were on our left. They'd been re-kitted out, but I don't think they were up to full strength. And but we were. And they were on our left, and they were supporting the Rifle Brigade, who were going to be the ground troops for taking the ridge. And it appears that we were being allowed to get a bit closer to that the next morning. Whether they were waiting for us to see the watch of arrows, I don't know. But if you imagine a ridge coming in a long curve, and you've got two people walking to it, and the curve goes round from the right to the left, if the two people walking are side by side, the one on the right is going to get to the ridge quicker than the one on the left. So it meant that our regiment, our leading squadrons, were going to get to the ridge sooner than the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment. So we were going to become the first nearest targets for the people on the ridge. So it wasn't long before we lost 5 tanks. Now, whoever it was, I don't know, but we were told to abort our direction, turn right and get up onto the ridge. Now that meant that would take us out of line of fire that had just knocked out 5 of our tanks, and also put us on the road on the ridge and bring us in on the left-hand flank of the people on the ridge, which would be a bit probably disconcerting for them. Well, this is what we intended doing. Well, when we gets up on the ridge, and again, I believe it was B Squadron who was with us, so C must have been in reserve. When we gets up on the ridge, we now come in view of the village of Ifs, the other side of the ridge. Now, according to the plan of the morning, the Canadians were operating on our right flank in conjunction with our attack. They were supposed to be level with us, and this village was supposed to have been taken by the Canadians by now. Unfortunately, they hadn't reached it. And when we gets up on the ridge, looking to in front, along the road, into the flank of the Bourjibus Ridge itself, we suddenly surprised to find we're getting fired at from the right-hand side, from this village, by the Germans. So instead of going in on the flank of the people on the Bras, Hubert Folly and Bras, we now have to defend ourselves from this other village, where we're losing tanks from them, you see. But the day wears on, and that was dealt with, and we gets into the villages, and there's the Rifle Brigade all dug in, the ridge is cleared, the 3rd tanks are coming up the valley. They've still got about 600 or 800 yards to do to reach like the houses and that, you see. And that's my recollection of how it finished around about tea time, you see. And we all settled down and waiting there. We know that Jerry's going to counterattack. He always counterattacks, you see. So we're sitting there, and suddenly there's artillery incoming fire, which is a bit unusual, because Jerry didn't, like, he hadn't got such a lot of artillery. It all seemed to be us who was using the artillery, see. But anyway, this Jerry artillery was firing, and this incoming shell fire was coming in, and suddenly we get a bang, and I wonder what had happened, because it felt as though somebody tapped me on the back of the head several times with the finger. And suddenly I thought, well, the set's gone dead, you know, got no sound in my earphones or nothing, you see. I thought, oh no, the set's gone dead. So I just looked around, and I thought, it's queer, these sacks of dirt had gone. And I looked, and the aerials had all gone. And I looked around the back, and looked over the back of the turret, and all the covers over the engine had gone. And there was the engine, running perfectly happy, but no covers on it, you see. And everything that was movable, the mudguards, the toolboxes, every bit of stuff around the turret had all gone. And what had happened, we'd had a shell landed right in the back of the tank behind the turret. And everything that was movable was moved, you see. So I thought, Christ. So I get staying in the turret, you see. And I was feeling a bit dazed, you know, sort of hazy. And I didn't look at it and sort of in a practical manner think, cool, we've had a shell on the back. You know, I sort of looked, I thought, Christ, you know, must have happened, you know. And I get staying in the turret again. I looks across, and Bill Bagley's there, and got his head in his hands. It's all blood running down his fingers and that. So I kicked him under the doings, and he looked up, dazed, you know, looks at me. I said, what's happened to you, Bag? He said, I reckon we've been hit. I said, I know we are. I said, it's cleared the back. I said, the flaps are all gone, I said. I said, are you hurt? So he said, I don't know, he said. He said, well, you're blood. So, of course, I was all blood everywhere. I said, bloody queer. I looks down, because immediately, when you first look down, it's in darkness. I looks down, and Denny Wells, a gunner, he's sitting down there, got his head in his hands, crouched down, like, you know, and I gives him a nudge with my boot, and he laid back, and his head flopped back, and he was covered in blood. And I said, are you all right, Denny? And he just wobbled his head as much as say, yeah, you know. And the three of us in the turret had all been wounded with shrapnel or blast or whatever. And, of course, the driver and the co-driver, they were totally untouched, you see, because they were set in a tank. The turret is like a cage, separate from the vehicle, really. And that was the situation. So we got a tank that was still a viable vehicle as regards fighting, except we got no communication internally or externally, and no covers on the engine, so we were vulnerable to anything. And although I was conscious, we're all wounded, but you're all right, right? So I said, I'll nip across to see Mr. Dolby. So I went across to Mr. Dolby's tank and climbed up. I said, we had a shell on the back. I said, we're gone. I said, everything's gone up the spade. I said, we've got no. I said, all the covers are gone. So he said, he said, it's just turned 7 o'clock. He said, we'll be finishing soon. He said, we had the buzz. He said, the counterattack's finished. He said, that's, you know. He said, look, he said, the 7th Armoured Div across there. And we could see, because they're all Cromwells, you see. The 7th Armoured Division, apart from one Sherman 17 pounder to a troop, they were totally equipped with Cromwell tanks, you see. Whereas our own brigade are Sherman tanks. So it was no good going to them for help. So Mr. Dolby said, make your way across the valley, he said, to the 7th Armoured, and get them to sort you out. I said, yeah, right. So it gets back in, you see. So I goes to Benny, goes round to the front of Benny, you see, the driver. I said, stick your head up, Ben. He stuck his head up. I said, see the 7th Armoured blokes down the other side of the valley there? Yeah. And I said, well, make your way across to them. He said, all right. I said, because I can't speak to you. So I said, you're on your own. Just drive across to them. So that was it. We drove across to them and eventually got to them. And the MO sorted us out. And the Wallace bloke sorted the radio stuff out. The fitters come and fitted the tank out with some new covers. Because what they were doing, knocked out vehicles, they were putting them into sort of heaps, as you might say. You know, all sorts of vehicles. And then they were cannibalising them for spare parts, or, you know, I mean, they could even take an engine out from one and put it in another, or, you know, and all that. So that was what they were doing. They were making these heaps of vehicles, and then I suppose Remy people would be notified by map reference where they were, and they could go and cannibalise them, you see. So the fitters sorted the tank out and put some mud guards on and stuff like that, you know. Anyway, they done all that. The Wallace blokes put us right with the Wallace sets and the aerials and all that, you see. And the MO sorted us 3-8, gave us crew cuts and that, you know. And we got some in your shoulders, you got some shrapnel in your shoulders and that. And anyway, he sorted us out, we got plaster all over us, right? And then we got a meal with them. They sent us round to their cooks, they got a meal on. And by about 9 o'clock, up as nine, just before it got dark, we was ready to move off again. So I said, right, we're going to try and find where the mob's got to. Well, of course, when we started to go back, we looked across the valley to where